Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. All parents have dreams for their kids. But what happens when your children have very different dreams for themselves? Ronald Berger takes that question on in his essay, I Saw a Playhouse, My Daughter Saw a Jail. It's read by Brian Cox. Brian plays Logan Roy in the HBO show Succession.
My year-old grandson, Leo, wraps his arm around my neck as we leave the diner in Barre, Vermont, where his mother, Anna, and my wife are having breakfast. Because Leo will not stop throwing utensils across the table, I offer to take him to a nearby hardware store to explore an environment where he cannot wreak as much havoc. After a protracted and chaotic adolescence, our younger daughter, Anna, has just begun her final year of college. This boy with flax blonde hair and light blue eyes is her gift to the family she's been trying to flee for the last decade. Toy cars, real trains, and mechanical objects of all size fascinate Leo. He and I spend our time together exploring lumber yards, railroad depots, and any highway department that possesses a road grader, an excavator, or a dump truck. As we enter the hardware store, the middle-aged woman working the cash register says, "Oh my Lord, can I hold that baby?" After Leo completes his first romantic conquest, we move toward merchandise he cannot destroy, metal fasteners, plastic pipes, and rope. But when I am distracted for a moment, he takes a large two-socket switch from a waist-high bin. "Hey, buddy," I whisper, returning the socket to the shelf, "this stuff is dangerous." I point to the plugs, junction boxes, and fluorescent lights, saying, "This is hot." He lays his head against my shoulder and smiles sweetly. I don't want to make my grandson fearful, but I feel the need to protect him. When we reach the wood products, I let him examine things more freely. "I built your mommy a playhouse one summer," I say. That summer, in my attempt to turn our suburban quarter-acre lot into child's paradise, I learned how to dig posts, pour cement, hang floor joists, work with oil-based paints and frame walls. But during the months I worked on it, Anna, who was nearing 10, began to turn her back on childhood. By the time I completed the playhouse at summer's end, she wouldn't have been caught dead in it. A year earlier, we had gone to London for 6 months. Anna, who didn't understand why she could not have as much freedom as her 16-year-old sister, had demanded the right to explore our neighborhood by herself and wandered through Hampstead Heath, a wilderness that is almost the size of Central Park, with the new and more liberated friends she had made there. When we returned to upstate New York, Anna, now in fourth grade, began producing prize-winning short stories and science projects. We felt lucky to have such an accomplished, if rather mutinous, daughter. The first signs of genuine teenage rebellion appeared when she was 11 on a week-long raft trip in Idaho, egged on by a 16-year-old girl from the suburbs of Los Angeles. Anna began shadowing the teenagers who spent their evenings smoking exotic hand-rolled cigarettes among the ponderosa pines that surrounded our campsites. Later that year, my wife and I took a 6-month academic sabbatical in Berkeley, California, and pulled Anna from school to do so. When we returned, the dynamic of her former friendships had changed, and she found herself excluded, whereupon she quickly fell in with a crowd of outcasts on the lookout for new recruits. Soon, teenagers wearing purple eyeshadows, spiked dog collars, and black leather could be found in our house at all hours. Anna began ignoring curfews, refusing to tell us where she was going and coming home in strange cars. I had spent years as a whitewater guide in the Adirondacks, and Anna had loved being there with me, even serving as my assistant several times. Thinking a return to that life might be the cure for her rebelliousness, I took her to the Adirondacks for a rafting trip. But every time I gave her instructions, an interaction that in the past had demonstrated our closeness, I now got a sullen stare, the kind that said that I did not understand or respect her. How does this happen? How does a child who spends her early life glued to your hip suddenly turn into a person who seems convinced that you were put on earth simply to frustrate her ambitions and dreams? Of course, I understood her feelings. My own father and I had a distant relationship in which much of what I received from him was withering criticism. Unable to appreciate my father's frustrations and limitations, which included periodic unemployment and debilitating illness, I had spent my own teenage years retreating from his dissatisfaction and rage. But I was going to be a different kind of father, one who would use reason, not rage. Even so, I didn't fully see that my hopes for Anna would not automatically become her hopes. I didn't understand how futile and naive was my goal of a trouble-free adolescence for my younger daughter. When Anna met a boy who confirmed her suspicion that suburbia was pure hell and her parents little more than well-mannered jailers, our troubles escalated. He was a brilliant student and talented cellist, but he had dropped out of high school, left his family, and lived in abandoned apartments, doorways, and eventually a cardboard box in the woods. Tall, gaunt, silent, poetic, and spellbindingly intense. He soon welcomed our daughter as part of his posse. They roamed the city together, two lost souls in search of romance and trouble. Attempting to rescue her, we sent Anna to a wilderness camp in Wyoming with the hope that she would embrace the values we thought we had failed to instill in her. When she returned a month later, bronzed, thin, and marathon fit, she set up a tarp in our yard. "I can't live in the house anymore," she said, "not after being in the mountains." Anna slept outside for 7 weeks, from Labor Day until late October, when persistent rain finally drove her indoors. During those weeks, I would go to our back door every night around 11 and stare at her sleeping form in the darkness, 20 yards from the house. Somewhere out there, less than half a mile away, was another child, this one living in a cardboard box. He and I were locked in a terrible struggle, one that I knew he would win. He had everything going for him, limitless energy, a willing accomplice, and a pure, uncomplicated contempt for everything I believed in. My fierce attachment to family, in particular. I was the embodiment of everything he despised, the guardian of obsolete behaviors and values, a dim-witted and overprotective, confused dinosaur who could not grasp the significance of reggae, rap, tattoos, tongue studs, and ripped clothing. It would be no contest. Anna, now 16, began staying away from home for days on end. And just as a thick fog began to blanket our neighborhood one Friday evening, she came back one last time. I met her on the front stoop. She was leaving for good, she said, and simply wanted to be able to retrieve her clothes. I said then exactly what you should not say in such circumstances. You're not going anywhere until you come inside and talk to us about it. The scene became increasingly surreal as her friends at the car began chanting, "Let Anna go! Let Anna go!" I continued to insist that she come in and talk, but she screamed, "You can't deny me my clothes!" before finally fleeing to the car and speeding off. 6 weeks later, school administrators, citing her record of truancy and disobedience, expelled her. Anna would take to the road for 2 years, traveling with her boyfriend out west and elsewhere, working odd jobs to survive. Then she would attend college for 2 years before dashing off again, this time with a new boyfriend, commencing what would be another 2 year stint on the road. Though she had physically rejected us, she didn't let go. Far from it. Throughout these years, she called us every few days to keep us abreast of her activities. I suspect she needed to know we cared about her. For us, the calls were worrisome, painful, but better than nothing, I suppose. It took some time for us to see the situation as it really had been. I didn't know what was at the root of Anna's rebellion, and perhaps I'll never know. But I do recognize that we failed in how we were only able to see the part of her that was reacting to us, not the child who was growing up much too quickly and was still terribly afraid. I could not admit until much later that no matter how understanding I claimed to be, I had behaved as though Anna were my surrogate, her behavior a reflection of my parenting skills, her beliefs a mirror of my ideals, her goals a product of my ambition. I may have said that I wished to set her free, but it was always my agenda that I hoped she would follow, my efforts as a father she would eventually acknowledge and admire. I had avoided repeating the mistakes of my father, but I had made different ones. When Anna finally settled down in northeast Vermont, she found a person to share her life with and a reason to begin her own family. And as grandchildren often do, Leo has shaken up our dynamic and given us all an excuse to see one another more often and in situations of real love and appreciation. He doesn't know the gift he brings, but the rest of us are well aware. As Leo and I explored the hardware store that morning, I pointed out the equipment that he would need to help his parents build their new home. "It'll be just like the playhouse I built for your mommy," I told him, "but much better." Our chore finished, a bag of tools in hand, Leo and I marched back to the now crowded diner. Anna smiles at us. "You roughnecks have fun?" As Leo leaped into her arms, I placed beside her the tools I bought to help her and her family build their new cabin in the woods.
That's Brian Cox reading Ronald Berger's essay, "I Saw a Playhouse, My Daughter Saw a Jail." There's more after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ronald Berger didn't want to talk to us for this episode because he wants to preserve his family's privacy. But he did allow us to share that he and his wife split their time between Albany, New York, and Sarasota, Florida these days. They both are retired from their teaching careers, but have continued writing. His daughter Anna and his grandson Leo, who's 15 years old now and doing well, are still a big part of their lives. We did ask actor Brian Cox what drew him to this essay.
I lost my father when I was 8, so fathers for me are kind of mythic in a way. And my mother was, she had a severe series of nervous breakdowns, which meant that she was quite incapacitated through most of my childhood. So it's an interesting story from the point of view of this man who I kind of completely empathize, but he's on a hiding to nothing with this rebellious child that isn't necessarily rebellious. She just is who she is. So that kind of gap that is between, you know, kids and their parents is just perennial. It goes on and on. And this little story captures it beautifully. You know, I read several pieces, and this piece resonated with me because, well, actually, because I don't have a daughter, but I have a son, and he's not quite at the wandering stage yet. But well, he is his own person, and a rebellious, slightly rebellious person at that. And my wife and I share this together. It's this question of creating boundaries for your child. My problem is I never, and also my wife's problem, is that we never had any boundaries as children. So this story kind of questions the notion of boundaries in many ways, especially when the grandfather says that, you know, the trouble he went to was trying to base everything on his values as opposed to what his daughter's values were. Well, it's a double whammy because it's very hard to know what your child's values are when they're so young, and especially if they're going off. And my son does that as well. He goes off with these friends, so one has no idea what's going on in his life. George Bernard Shaw talks about, in his play Misalliance, he talks about the great shyness between parents and their children. And I think there is an innate shyness that you don't know the ground on which you tread because it's different ground from the ground on which you tread, as it were, when you were young. So it's always hard to know where you go. And the thing is that in the end, it writes itself no matter what.
Thanks to Brian Cox for reading this week's essay. You can see him playing Logan Roy in Succession on HBO. Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, told us why he connected with Ronald's piece.
Ronald's essay, being a parent myself, just reminds me of the hardest choices a parent faces. And it's always this difficult choice between support and needing to protect them. And, you know, when Ronald talks about his own battles with his father when he was growing up and needing to sort of break free and then sees himself in that same role, it's such a reckoning kind of feeling. Like, you never think you're going to be oppressive in the way that you felt oppressed as a child, and then you are. You know, then the shoe is on the other foot, and you find yourself saying things that your parents said to you, and, you know, I always admire writers and their families who are willing to wade into these really dark, tough areas of life and present it back to the rest of us who are all dealing with the same stuff but don't have that same kind of bravery.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. If you like the show, leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.